Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. This week, we've got meteor showers. Song of the Week is by the Black and White Years, and a new analysis of climate models that yielded some concerning results. Here's your scientist soundbite.
In mid-November, the shower that's happening every November is the Leonid meteor shower, which is one of the most famous meteor showers anyway, and this year is going to be a great year to watch it.
That's sky watcher Deborah Bird. More with her about this week's meteor showers in a few, but first, Emily Howard and I are going to give you the science news of the week. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, Mike. So, scientists formerly knew the rare spade-toothed beaked whale, considered the rarest whale in the world, only from three partial skulls collected from New Zealand and Chile over a 140-year period. Now they realize that two whales of this rare species washed up on a beach in New Zealand and died there in 2010. No one recognized the whales at first, instead mistaking them for another whale species. Scientists have now set the record straight, reporting in the November 6th issue of the journal Current Biology.
A new study by scientists at the University of Miami School of Marine and Atmospheric Science may be able to help forecast eruptions at volcanoes. The study used new technology that analyzed deformation prior to the eruption of active volcanoes in Indonesia's West Sunda Arc. The study uncovered evidence that several volcanoes did in fact inflate prior to eruptions due to the rise of magma. This is the first unambiguous evidence that remotely detected ground deformation could help to forecast eruptions at volcanoes.
The 2007 IPCC report projected a global sea level rise between 0.2 and 0.5 meters by the year 2100. But current measurements of sea level rise suggest Earth's seas are rising at the maximum rate proposed by the IPCC, or faster. These measurements suggest a rise of 1 meter or more by the end of the century. That's according to University of Colorado geologist Bill Hay, who presented his results on November 4th at the meeting of the Geological Society of America.
Astronomers say that Comet Hergenrother, a faint comet that nonetheless provided some excitement to those with large telescopes earlier this month, has now begun to split apart. This comet reached its perihelion, or closest point to our sun, on October 1st. It was expected to be exceedingly faint, but the comet had an outburst of gas and dust, and as a result, it briefly became more than 500 times brighter than expected. As of about October 26th, Comet Hergenrother is splitting apart. And that's Science News of the Week. Thanks, Emily.
No prob.
Song of the Week is by the Black and White Years, who are busy at work on a new album, out on Modern Insider in 2013. This song is called Modern Science.
Yeah.
Listening to Earth Sky 22. You can find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here to talk about the global night sky, meteor showers. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Mike. Meteor showers. Yeah, autumn is one of the best time of years to see meteor showers. Mm-hmm. That's Northern Hemisphere autumn to you, Mike. Mm-hmm. And it's because there are several major showers that are going on around now. And in mid-November, the shower that's happening every November is the Leonid meteor shower, which is one of the most famous meteor showers anyway. And this year is going to be a great year to watch it.
Great. So why is it so famous?
Well, it's famous because the comet, meteor showers and annual showers like this are spawned by comets that are in orbit around the sun. So comets are icy, fragile bodies. And as they move in orbit around the sun, they litter their orbits with icy debris. So this debris just stays in the comet's orbit. But this stuff, this icy debris, is moving in these streams through space, which astronomers call meteoroid streams. Mm-hmm. And so whenever Earth crosses over one of these streams, the comet may be nowhere nearby, we have an annual meteor shower. So the comet that's associated with the Leonid meteor shower is called Temple-Tuttle. And that particular comet has about a 33-year orbit around the sun. So whenever Temple-Tuttle is nearby, there's a chance for a really amazing meteor shower. And the first time that that happened in modern history was in the year 1833. So that was an amazing event, which, of course, at that time there were, you know, newspapers and so on all around the world recording this event. And, you know, woodcuts were made of what the meteors looked like in the night sky. It happened again 33 years later when the comet was nearby again in 1866. In our modern times, in our lifetimes, or at least my lifetime, the most amazing meteor shower that's ever happened was a Leonid meteor shower. It was the Leonid meteor shower of 1966. And that was visible in the southwestern United States. I didn't see it, darn it, but I know a whole bunch of people who did see it. And there were thousands of meteors per second seen in this meteor shower. Not per hour, but per second. You would look up in the night sky and it was literally raining meteors. So when people think about meteor showers, you know, they think about that. They think about, it sounds like it's going to be like a shower of rain. Well, that 1966 Leonid meteor shower really was like a shower of rain. And the cool thing about it, let me just say this, the cool thing about it was that meteors, of course, in annual showers, all radiate from a single point in the sky. So if you were sitting there on the Earth looking at that Leonid meteor shower in 1966, you would have seen all those thousands of meteors per second streaming out from a single point in the sky. So that would have looked very Star Trek-ish.
Yeah, looks like you're zooming through space.
Yeah, and in fact, we are zooming through space, and that's exactly what's happening. So we're zooming through space, and we're encountering this meteoroid stream that's striking above our head, and that's giving us this view of these meteors all streaming out from a single point in the sky.
What about in 1999? Did anything significant happen?
Well, there was another good shower in 1999, not as good as the 1966 shower, but people did see hundreds of meteors per hour. And so a lot of people around do remember that one. The Leonids, in most years, they might produce on the order of, say, you know, a couple tens of meteors per hour, mm-hmm. but still enough to put on a good show. So that's the shower that's coming up in mid-November, the Leonid meteor shower. The best mornings to see it this year are the mornings of November 16th and 17th.
Okay, and I understand the North Taurid meteor shower is happening before that.
That's right. This is a good year for the North Taurids, too. So the North Taurids are more visible around, say, the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, actually the days leading up to the Leonid meteor shower. And you might see some Leonids on those mornings, too, because these meteor streams in space take a while to ford. And so we're passing through a meteor stream for, you know, several weeks at a time. So if you're hearing this program on, say, the 10th, 11th, 12th, anytime around there through the middle of the month after the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th even, go outside between midnight and dawn and try to get to a dark location. The moon is generally out of the way. The new moon is on November 13th, according to U.S. clocks. And new moon is the moon that's between the Earth and Sun, so it means that it's crossing the sky with the Sun during the day. And that means it's gone from the night sky, and so that's great. That's good news for meteor watchers.
Great. So the North Taurid meteor showers, followed by the more famous Leonid meteor showers, happening around now. Get to a dark sky and catch the show.
That's right.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Mike.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Here's a song from Dana Falconberry. Check out her new album, Lilano.
Did you think of me that day when you drove down the driveway? I was a handful then. I know, with my shoes untied, I wouldn't watch the sunset without a coat and a helmet. I was a quavering maple leaf about to drown. But on the shore of the lake last fall, I don't know if you heard or saw, but I found a crow in the sand, and I asked, am I missing something? From you and laughed, I meant I was sorry. Just so you know, I read the letter you wrote to me when you moved back to Kentucky. Said the hills are so green, my God, you should see them. And now, though it's early spring, cold in the morning, and I keep my curtains mostly closed.
Climate scientists have conducted a survey to see how accurate their climate models are compared to current temperatures. A new study from the National Center for Atmospheric Research suggests that climate models that predict hotter temperatures more closely match what is happening now. Deborah Bird is back to talk about these findings. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Mike. So this result was announced this week. by two scientists from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is also called NCAR. The scientists are Kevin Trenberth and John Fasulo. And what they did, let me say first that, you know, you hear these temperature ranges for what might happen as Earth continues to warm over this century. We've already measured warming that's been going on for some time now. And the climate scientists use models, so they use computer models, to try to project how much warming there might be in the century ahead. And whenever they express the results of those models, they always express them in a range. And a range that you commonly hear is between 2 and 11 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's just background for what I'm about to say next.
Over what term in the future?
Oh, until the year 2100. So 2 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit, that's the amount of warming in Earth's average global temperature that's been projected to occur with global warming over the course of this 21st century.
Wow. Okay.
You know, a climate model is kind of just a simulation of reality. It's not reality itself, and no one can really predict reality itself in advance. But this is the best we've got here on planet Earth today to try to do that. So a climate model consists of a number of parameters. They have to input different things into the model to make it match reality as best they possibly can. And so there's not just one climate model. In fact, there are dozens of climate models that scientists at different institutions use to try to make these projections. So what Trenberth and Fasulo did was look at 16 of the major climate models that are used by scientists. And they looked in particular at the subtropics. So that's the region of Earth that's outside the tropics, but still not subject to, say, snowfall in the winter. It's more like where you and I live, Mike, here in Austin, Texas, or latitudes like our latitude. We're at 29 degrees north latitude. So that type of latitude, say the latitude of, you know, Mexico or northern Africa and so on around the globe, the Middle East, that type of latitude. That was the latitude they were looking at. And they looked in particular at three things. They looked at temperature, they looked at moisture, and they looked at the role of clouds.
Okay, so what about the role of clouds in climate models? We've heard a lot about that recently.
Yeah, in fact, not even just recently, but the whole time I've been in reporting about science, which has been, you know, 35, close to 40 years now, scientists have been talking about the role of clouds in climate models. And so clouds are a complication in the climate model because they absorb things and they also reflect things. They absorb things like light and heat, and they also reflect light and heat. And so how they're doing that, you know, the different densities of clouds and the different types of clouds are doing that in complicated ways all over the Earth right now. So looking at these clouds in climate models has been one of the reasons that they can't make these projections very accurately. And so what Fasulo and Trenberth did was they looked in particular at relative humidity in the subtropics, in the subtropical region. And they found that the relative humidity and clouds were behaving in such a way that matched the climate models whose projections were on the high end of the temperature range. So in other words, when you hear that number, that 2 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit projected by the end of this century, these scientists are saying that according to their research, it might be likely that we're going to see a temperature increase at the high end of that range.
It's frightening.
It is.
So there's bound to be some other effects that go with that besides temperature rise.
Yeah, I mean, the types of things that we've been seeing lately, one of the things that climate scientists say is likely to happen is that we'll have more extremes. And so something like Hurricane Sandy striking the East Coast, no scientist would ever come out and say, or few scientists would ever come out and say that Hurricane Sandy was caused by global warming, because scientists don't like to say that one thing causes
right.
another unless they absolutely know that to be true. And in the case of Hurricane Sandy, it's hard to know that to be true because those kinds of events do happen over time. But we do seem to be seeing a greater frequency of that type of event. And I know, Mike, that in my memory, and I'm in my early 60s now, it's pretty unusual to see a hurricane go that far north. And yet now we've seen them going that far north in recent years. So it seemed to be that a decade ago, climate scientists were talking a lot about hurricanes, and they were talking about the strength of hurricanes and the frequency of hurricanes. But I don't think 10 years ago people were talking about the fact that hurricanes were going to move further north. Now it looks as if that might be happening.
Okay, so what's the bottom line here?
Well, I think the bottom line is that, you know, we humans are a very adaptable species, and in the century ahead, we're going to have some things to adapt to. I mean, I believe we can, but we're going to have to start paying attention to the fact that Earth is getting warmer, and we need to start figuring out how we're going to adapt.
Right. Well, thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Deborah Bird, speaking about a new climate analysis that was published in the journal Science on November 8th. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded in Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Special thanks to our musical contributors. For more information about the music or the science you heard, please visit earthsky.org. Thanks for listening. Till next week, be good to one another. I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.